I'd like to tell you a little bit about how neutrino masses fit into the big picture of particle physics. So that's the whole idea. But as you all know, I'm sure you have a lot of seminars on neutrinos here. Since the snow played such an important role in clarifying a lot of the information that we have now. So in the last, 10, 14 years, there has been just tremendous number of very significant discoveries in neutrino mass physics, which of course itself is a sign of physics beyond the standard model, probably the only sign right now, which is definite. And lots of things have come together, including a very new result, which is a couple of months old, and it's still developing, which is the story of theta 1-3, one of the mixing angles, and people are very excited about it. So what I would like to do is to sort of give my take on the whole story with some introduction. So what's happening right now is that we know a lot about the quark sector. Of course, quark flavor is sort of completely experimentally determined, although we don't understand why what is happening is happening. Similar things are almost close to happening in the neutrino sector because lots of the masses and mixings are getting known, although there is still a lot to be determined in that sector. And yet there are ways one should try to sort of have a big picture where both things fit in, and that's where my talk will focus on. Okay, so just as a way of introduction, of course, two fundamental puzzles of the standard model is the origin of mass. So if the Higgs discovery is confirmed and everything, so that part of the story will be settled. But the big question that we'll have to worry about is what's the origin of flavor? In other words, where the fermion masses, mixings, the CP violation, the P violation, all these kind of observations that have been made, where are they coming from? And of course, neutrino masses and mixings is a big part of this discussion. So we'll have to, hopefully, we can integrate all of that and get some kind of a broad picture that fits both these stories. So what's the flavor puzzle? Please interrupt me during the talk because I don't want to fall asleep. Okay, so the flavor puzzle, of course, essentially starts with how you look at the fermion masses in the context of gauge theory. Okay. Is there a pointer or I should just... Okay, great. Yeah. So what you do in any typical model construction is you write a mass term in the Lagrangian. So we have quarks, we write a mass term for the quarks up and down here. Then we write a mass term for the charged leptons, electron, muon, and tau, which is over here. And then you write something for the neutrinos. Now here I have made an assumption because we do not know yet whether the neutrinos are their own antiparticles or they have a quantum number, which is the lepton number, so that their masses should be Dirac type. But the prevailing theoretical belief seems to be that they most likely are neutrinos and are Majorana type. And I will tell you why that belief is persisting. And then, of course, you write the Hermitian conjugate. So you have this thing, all these masses, and then you diagonalize them because the mass matrices connect different flavors, so you don't have definite eigenstates of the mass matrix. So you rotate them by making transformations both on the left and the right side by unitary matrices. So you have got some diagonal mass term. And similarly, for the neutrinos, you have some mixing. So what you, therefore, find experimentally the sandwiching of the up quark rotation matrix and the down quark rotation matrix. That's the very familiar stuff. But that's the CKM matrix, so-called. And this is the one which goes by the name of PMNS matrix, where you have the charged leptons and the neutrinos. So that you put them together. And so you have these 9 elements, or maybe more if they are complex. And this is the quark sector. Now, already in the quark sector, you notice that there is kind of a hierarchy so that you have this mixing much smaller than this, much bigger than that, much bigger than that. So lambda is the Kabibo angle, which is the sort of usual hierarchy issue in the quark sector. And we will slowly discuss what is going on in the lepton sector and why, how to understand all of that. Okay, so that's really the first part of the flavor puzzle. If you look at the neutrino sector, you write the neutrino flavor eigenstates in terms of the mass eigenstates. So these have definite masses, definite masses, definite masses, which of course is how you get oscillation from one flavor to the other as neutrinos come from a source and are detected at a detector at some distance. And this matrix can be generally parameterized by three matrices like this. And if it is Majorana, then there is another diagonal matrix, which is the which is only unitary diagonal matrix. I have not written that over here because we really know nothing about that part. So what we have is three angles. This is the so-called atmospheric angle, which takes from the, essentially you could think of it as taking from muon to tau. This one is 1.3, which takes essentially from u, nu e to nu tau or something like that. And this is the solar angle. And the story, as I will tell you, is that this is the one that just got most likely determined in the last 2 months. This was already known, both these things, since 1998 from Super Kamiokande, Snow, and all the other experiments that were done. Okay, so this, therefore, is the PMN matrix. What has been known for 10 years is that this 2.3, the atmospheric angle, is roughly equal to 1 over root 2. And the solar angle is roughly equal to 1 over root 3. Or roughly, you could say they're large compared to what we know for the quark sector. Okay. The recent theta 1.3 result is amazing in the sense that it is also large in the scheme of things that we are talking about. Because you remember that the VUB, which is the corner angle in the quark sector, which is analogous to this, is only 0.004 or so. So this is pretty large. So the, of course, before the Japanese earthquake, these people in T2K, they did a measurement which gave limits like this, but they have now been surpassed by two recent experiments, Doyabai, which came out a couple of months ago, which says that sine square 2 theta 1.3 is 0.092, or if you write in terms of radians, it is about 0.15 radians with 5 sigma result. And then Reno experiment, which is the Korean experiment with reactors again, and this is a 6 sigma, which is pretty much similar to this, 0.17 or something like that. Okay? So these are large things, because remember, Kabibo angle is about 0.22. So this is, and you know, this guy had no right to be that large. Okay? Okay, so this is the story. Therefore, we have theta 2.3, which is large, theta 1.2, the solar angle, which is large. And now the corner angle seems to be large. Okay? And this is the current best fit value for the masses and mixings done by these guys. And you see all these numbers. You don't have to really know all of them. Here I have pointed out one thing which is different from the mixing angles, which is also a little bit of a puzzle, which is that if you look at the solar mass difference square divided by the atmospheric mass difference square, so this is the sort of 2.3 sector, this is the 1.2 sector, you see that this is also almost the square of the Kabibo angle. So somehow, Kabibo angle, which is something which characterizes the quark sector, seems to make its appearance as you try to write down these mixing angles and mass differences. Right, but this is sort of the tip, you know, this is a generic kind of thing. I mean, you could take different ratios, but if you look at the quark sector, these mass difference squares are huge, right? This ratio is small number, right? And this is, I mean, for example, MS over MB isn't really of the order of the Kabibo angle. So this is something, of course, yeah, you could tell, but the reason I'm writing this down is because at some point I would like to understand this in terms of the quark sector. Okay? That's what we will do. Okay, so let's now go from data to physics. So what is important to know so that we can construct a model? That's our goal. We want to understand the big picture of quarks and leptons. So we want to know how we go from these observations for the masses and mixings to how we can construct a model. So how do we do that? Well, we have to construct what we call the mass matrix, which is the neutrino mass as well as the charged lepton mass. And the way you do that is the fact that the atmospheric mixing angle is already large and of the order of 45 degrees almost, that tells you that in the 2.3 sector, the mass matrix has to pretty much look like this, with this epsilon again being of the order of Kabibo angle. Okay, so that's something that was suspected as soon as the results 1998 were given about the atmospheric oscillation. If you include the large solar angle, then essentially you say that these two entries must also be of the order of the Kabibo angle. I'm, of course, assuming normal hierarchy, which is similar to the quark sector. If you do inverted hierarchy, all this remains same, but there is some change in this sector. Okay, so I will not get into that. On the other hand, you look at the quark sector, the quark mass matrix has, of course, this funny pattern where everything sort of smaller. This is large, smaller, smaller, and smallest. Okay, so that's the pattern. Whereas over here, it's a completely different pattern. And the curious thing, of course, is the lambda, which is the one that characterizes the quark sector, is making its appearance in the form of this epsilon in the various leptonic sectors. Okay.
Is this the quark mass matrix? Is this the basis where the up quarks are diagonal?
No, in this basis, it's the charged leptons are diagonal. Yeah. But charged lepton, since they are hierarchical, you don't expect them to sort of affect this kind of thing very much. Oh, in the quark sector, yeah, the up quark is diagonal, right.
The up quark
diagonal. Yeah. So it's sort of the mass difference, yeah. If you had down quark diagonal, then it would look similar in the other sector, right? It's sort of, but one of them is diagonal. Is that what your question was? Or? MB outside, yeah. So the point is that neutrino masses no hierarchy unlike the quark masses. And the question that I will address in the, yeah.
What about the right-handed?
Neutrinos.
No, right-handed quark rotation.
And you can always develop theories where both mixing angles are equal and stuff like that. I'm simply writing down the mixing matrix, which is sort of the left-handed part. Okay. So the question, therefore, is can you write a big picture? And this is where we have been thinking about for the last several years now, that how do we connect this very funny pattern, this very kind of pattern, in a sort of a complete quark lepton big picture? Okay. So let's try to see how we do that. Okay, so the natural idea that you think about, of course, is the setup of grand unification where all matter becomes same and all forces become same. This subject was very popular in the 80s, somehow lost its popularity in the 90s or so, so that you have all kinds of big conferences, no discussion of grand unification at all. But still, there are all kinds of searches for proton decay, etc., which I will talk a little bit towards the end today, where these is the crucial part of the discussion. Okay? So what I will talk about is that despite these differences between the quarks and the lepton flavor patterns, there is a property of the grand unified theories that allows an explanation of the neutrino flavor pattern in terms of the quark flavor pattern. Okay? So in other words, you don't have to assume anything really, any crazy symmetry or any kind of big thing, just the property that class of grand unified theories have certain properties that these sort of automatically get linked to each other in a way that you even predict that theta 1, 3 is large, and this is of the order of theta 1, 3 squared. Okay, so this is sort of the basic outline of my talk. And please stop me again whenever there is some issues. Okay? So what is the grand unification theory? Well, it is essentially the idea. So this is sort of the recital of the standard virtues of grand unified theories, which all of you, I'm sure, know, which is that the fact that the three couplings determined at the weak scale, MZ scale, and you assume supersymmetry around a TEV means that through the quantum field theory evolution of the couplings, they simply go and meet at one point, roughly speaking. And this value of the couplings is inverse of the alpha is about 22, and the value of the mass where they meet is somewhere around 10 to the 16, which is, of course, what you would like things to happen, because as we will see, once you go to grand unified theories, in the quarks and leptons are part of the same multiplets, you will have proton decay. And proton decay requires that the scale better be high. Okay, so that's the idea. And of course, it has other virtues, like you have electric charge quantization. It unifies all matter, connects quarks to leptons. So it gives you some hope that maybe we can understand the connection between quarks and leptons. And this is what I want to pursue today. Okay, so there are also other possible hints that things like this could be happening. For example, if you just do naive RG extrapolation of the bottom quark and the tau lepton mass to the gut scale, you find that these two are roughly almost equal. The muon mass is roughly three times the strange quark mass, and three, of course, is reminding something like a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient or something. And there are relations like this, Me, mu equal to MDMS, et cetera. And also there are, as I have been emphasizing, the ratio of solar to atmospheric also possibly related to all of these.
But so this 3 is also a function of 5, right? Because S quark used to be heavier and lighter.
Sorry?
What I meant is that 3 is a function of 5, because S quark used to be, you know, heavier.
Well, if you take the simplest extrapolation, that is, you know, it's roughly of the, yeah, but this is less than this. I don't actually, for my discussion, I don't care what this is really. But this is sort of more crucial to what I will be telling you about. Okay? And that depends on the top quark mass and the alpha strong and so on. So that's more stable in some sense. So the question I would like to discuss is, are neutrino masses another signal of the grand unified theories? And if so, what do they tell us about the masses and mixing patterns? Okay, so that's the next item. So let's start from the standard model and see how you want to understand the neutrino masses. Okay, well, of course, the standard model has no right-handed neutrino, so therefore neutrino mass is zero. And there are two ways that you can introduce neutrino mass into the theory. One way is you take the standard model, add the right-handed neutrino, and therefore to the Lagrangian, you can add this term now, which is the lepton doublet, the Higgs, and the right-handed neutrino, and its Hermitian conjugate, and nothing else. If you do that, then of course you get neutrino mass, neutrino to be Dirac particle so that it's not its own antiparticle, and its mass is given by some Yukawa over here times the electroweak wave. But if you remember what the order of magnitude of these masses are, which are sort of sub-electron volt, like 0.1, 10 to the minus 3 electron volt, etc., you see that this coupling has to be extremely tiny, something like 10 to the minus 12, and of course, you would naturally ask, isn't it too small for comfort? I mean, that, and why is it so small? Okay, so that's an issue. So of course, there was an alternative possibility which was proposed by Weinberg in 1979, which is that it could be that there is some high scale physics so that you write this kind of effective operators, which is L, lepton Higgs doublet over mass. And that way, once you break electroweak symmetry, the mass is of the order of V electroweak square over M. And of course, you don't know what M is. So therefore, you could, in principle, make M sufficiently big so that you understand why the neutrino masses are small. And of course, this was sort of the starting point of several papers which were written in 1979, et cetera, which simply provided a realization of the Weinberg paradigm within the so-called seesaw model. Okay. So what's the seesaw idea? The idea is that, of course, you take right-handed neutrino and add to the standard model, but give it a Majorana mass. Because it is a singlet, you can write a gauge-invariant Majorana mass. And once you do that, you have a mass, you have a diagram like this, where a left-handed neutrino comes, it gives rise to right-handed neutrino, and then there is a Majorana mass over here, and then the same thing repeats, and you write it down. What you find is that the mass of this is now given by this term, which, of course, was Weinberg's idea, but now this mass has got mass in the denominator has got a definite ID attached to it, which is it is the Majorana mass of the right-handed neutrino, which being a singlet could therefore be heavy. And of course, once something is large, then you would like to know why it is large, et cetera. And that, as I will see, if you look at the typical values that one should put in here, if you have a grand unified theory, you would expect, for example, the 3-3 entry of this matrix to be of the order of top quark, because the top quark is the analog of the right of the neutrinos, and the bottom quark is the analog of the charged leptons. So therefore, you expect this to be of the order of top quark. And if you put the top quark mass over here, you can then have an estimate of what this right-handed neutrino mass is, and you find that this is about 10 to the 14 GeV. And if you recall, the gut scale is about 10 to the 16 GeV. So these are suggestively close, and one would therefore think that this seesaw mechanism probably implies that there is some kind of a gut picture, both for neutrinos and the quarks. Okay? And of course, that's not something that everybody agrees with, because since this is so far away from the weak scale Some people would like to discover the seesaw physics at the weak scale, and therefore they put in low mass right-handed neutrinos, etc. And that certainly is not natural in the grand unified theories.
So I didn't realize that Weinberg was first. Was it the operator was proposed first, and
then all these models? Yes. Well, actually, the sequence of, I don't think how much one influenced the other is not so clear, but at least now the sequence of events were like that. See, Weinberg was actually looking at baryon number violating, lepton number violating interactions that he could write down in the standard model using higher dimensional operator. And he did write down this operator as something that's relevant for neutrino mass. Okay, the baryon number violating ones were 1 over lambda square. This is more dominant than others. So but then he didn't say anything about how you get it, etc. And then all these papers came out, which sort of put definite models, SO10, left, right, this, that, etc. Okay, so that's how things happened in the 1979. Yeah. And of course, there is also another appeal of the gut scale seesaw, which is that it has the potential to explain the origin of matter in the universe.
Okay, in some cases, like gravity, you have a non-neutral model without some model for it.
That's right, yeah.
So,
I mean, it's always nice to have an ultraviolet completion of a theory so you can make predictions. Because once you have just the operator, then I wrote down the operator, I understand something, but I can't tell you anything definite about the physics at that scale. Okay, so now once you have a definite theory, then you can say more. Okay, so that was the whole idea. And
it's
not a definite.
You just put in the value of the
gravity. I know, but it's not a theory in the sense that you can renormalize it. And
well, gravity is.
Okay,
gravity
okay.
Theory.
Yeah, sure. Okay. But I still maintain that it's interesting to have ultraviolet completions which give you a certain operator. I think that's the idea. And as I will show you, that leads to a lot more than what Weinberg could have told us. Okay. And for example, mixings and mass orderings and so on. Once you have a definite theory, you can make a prediction. Okay. So another appeal of this near gut scale seesaw is the following. You have a Majorana particle, so that goes to lepton and Higgs, and also it goes to anti-lepton and its complex conjugate. And with CP violation, it can give rise to a difference between the lepton number, which is delta L not equal to zero, and that is in the early universe. And of course, once the universe cools down to the electroweak phase transition temperature, you have these sphalerons which connect B to L because sphaleron interactions conserve B minus L. So these lepton asymmetry that was generated in the very early moments now gets converted to baryon asymmetry. So that's nice because that sort of tells you that this is one alternative way to understand the origin of matter. And you probably know historically that by the time this sphaleron ideas came up, people quickly realized that the gut scale, usual gut scale, baryogenesis isn't going to work because that conserves B minus L and is not going to really survive this sphaleron interaction. So this therefore became an alternative way to understand matter. And what is much more promising is that this kind of origin of matter is now connected to what's going on in the neutrino sector. For example, the recent excitement of the theta-1-3 is that because of large theta-1-3, you could expect to determine the phase that goes in there, just like the analog of the CKM phase. And once you have that phase, you will have some contribution from that phase to the lepton asymmetry or the origin of matter question. Okay, so that therefore gave an added excitement to the whole idea, and therefore one could try to build theory. This, by the way, also you could not do without a definite theory. I don't think just the Weinberg answers would do that. Okay, so once you have the gut picture, what is the challenge? Well, the challenges are enormous because we notice that the PMNS matrix looks pretty much like this, a whole bunch of Clebsch-Gordan-like looking numbers. And by the way, with a zero here, which we know now is not zero, whereas CKM is this way, as I have been emphasizing. Or, for example, the neutrino mass looks like this, whereas the quark sector, the masses are completely hierarchical. So what I would like to emphasize is that people have been searching as to how to do this, and what I will tell you is what we have done in the last several years is that there is a picture on a group called SO10, which sort of resolves this puzzle. In other words, you give one, the other one follows. Okay, so I think that's, to us, looked interesting, and we have been pursuing that, and in fact, one of the earliest predictions of a large theta 1, 3 was from this model. And I will tell you about that. Okay. So what is the SO10, SUSY, GOT big picture for neutrinos? So what's SO10? Well, it's a big group. Okay. You start from standard model, goes to SU5, then SU5 is part of the group SO10. But you don't need to know too much group theory. The only thing you need to know is that the SO10 has got a representation which is 16-dimensional spinner representation. And 16 is an interesting number because if you count the number of fermions, left and right chirality, including the right-handed neutrino, then what you have are 16 particles. Okay? So these 16 particles therefore fit very nicely into the spinner representation, which then unifies all matter, including the right-handed neutrino. SU5, by the way, cannot do that because it does not have any space, any room for the right-handed neutrino. You have to put it in as an extra particle. I don't think so. I don't think that's because people still are doing SU5. I mean, I'm not one of them, but people like to sort of do simpler things they can handle. But to me, if CISO is right, I think the case is more compelling for SO10 rather than SU5. That's just my take. And then towards the end, I will make a comment as to how you distinguish between the SO10 model from the SU5 model. I'm coming to it. Yeah, that will be part of my discussion towards the end. Okay, so this SO10, therefore, as we said, since it is a right-handed neutrino, it contains all the ingredients for CISO. And what we pointed out almost 20 years ago is that the minimal renormalizable model of this type has some large representation from the Higgs, which unfortunately I will not discuss too much about. What happens is that just like the doublet of the standard model gives mass to the quarks and the leptons, you have three representations which give mass to the fermions in the SO10 model. One of them is 10 and another is 126. Okay, so that's the dimension sounds large, but if you really get down to it, it's not that difficult a thing to control. So this, what we pointed out many years ago is that once you have this framework, it is very predictive for neutrino masses because that has extremely fewer number of parameters, and the quark sector and the charged lepton masses pretty much determine all the. So you predict things, and most of these predictions, we don't know the CP phase yet, but the other predictions are sort of consistent, and I will explain how you get to that and so on. The other thing about this 126 for all the experts in the audience is that if you have SO10 with 126, that conserves R parity, which is what you need to have a stable dark matter. So that was another reason for considering these things. So that, therefore, is the model that I will discuss in the remaining time. Okay, so here I'm getting to be a little bit technical because there are now several varieties of CISO models which have been discovered since the 1979 work, and I will focus on two of them. I will explain what they are. The first one I already did, you have standard model and they put in a right-handed neutrino, and this is what the neutrino mass looks like. So if you want to understand the flavor structure of this one, you probably have to have a flavor sensitive values over here because the hierarchy of this one within the GOT framework is likely to be like the quarks. On the other hand, there was pretty within a year of the 1979 type 1 CISO, the type 2 CISO was discovered, where people pointed out that you could have the same kind of a formula where a large mass suppresses the electroweak square, where you have a Higgs exchange, not a neutral singlet right-handed fermion. So this, therefore, is an alternative. But here you see you don't need to have a huge flavor sensitivity in this sector to get any kind of mass. All it needs is some kind of a coupling, which has to have some pattern. Okay? So it turns out that in the context of CISO models, the 126 that I told you about, that has the flavor structure in it. And that is what, as I will explain all of this, that is what is responsible for the neutrino mass. Okay, so let's just go into that discussion. So I want to explain a little bit what is the type 2 CISO and how does that arise. Well, actually, you can understand type 2 CISO also within the context of standard model. All you have to do is take the standard model, include a triplet Higgs, and a lot of people still nowadays are working on how to discover the triplet Higgs at the LHC, but I'm not thinking about the LHC. The, my triplet Higgs is much heavier than the LHC energies. So what you have is a potential like this. This is the most general potential you can write down. And you minimize it, and what you find is that the Higgs vacuum expectation value of the triplet is given by a seesaw-like formula. Okay? And of course, it is this one which couples to the neutrinos. So therefore, the neutrino mass will follow this behavior. Okay? So therefore, this is what the type 2 seesaw content is. And it turns out that the 126-dimensional field of SO10 contains this particle inside it. Okay, so that's, you know, that's a little bit technical. But if you expand this field in terms of standard model content, this one is part of that. Okay, that's why you generate fermion masses in SO10 with 10 and 126. Okay, so that's the idea. Okay, so what happens next? Well, it turns out that I'm now getting a little bit technical, but hopefully stop me because this is not really that hard to explain. What happens is that how do you get masses in the case of in a gas theory? Well, you have two fermions and a Higgs boson. Two fermions and a Higgs boson. Now, of course, in the SO10 theory, we have a 10 Higgs, which is coming over here, and a 126 Higgs, which is coming over here. And these guys becoming big representations have standard model doublets in there. For example, this guy has two standard model doublets, which is like the up and down doublets of the MSSM. And this guy also has two of them, which are like up and down of the MSSM, and so on. So you give general wave to all these things. There is up wave, there is up wave, down, down, et cetera. Now, the crucial thing that grand unification does for us, it relates this MD to ML, because you see that there's a 1 over here, there's a minus 3 over here, reminiscent of the relation between strange quark mass and muon. So that is predominantly responsible for that with small corrections. And you see that if you look at the number of couplings and number of free parameters, there are not that many, because I can always choose a basis, so this diagonalizes, so this has three parameters. And if I ignore CP violation for the time being, then this has got 6 parameters because it's a symmetric matrix. Okay, so you essentially have got 6 plus 3, which is 9, and then you have got 1, 2, 3, 4, 13 parameters describing all of fermion masses, including the neutrinos. Okay. And of course, the 13 parameters are all determined by the quark sector except one, and you have got complete predictivity for the neutrino sector. That's what Babu and I pointed out in 93. And what happens then is that you look at the neutrino mass, and if you assume that this term dominates, then you have a sum rule which involves the neutrino mass matrix, the down quark mass matrix, and the charged lepton. And this is kind of crucial. So I want you to at least appreciate this much, that once you are within this simple renormalizable SO10 framework, there is a sum rule which involves the neutrino mass matrix, down quark mass matrix, and charged lepton mass matrix. And it is this minus sign which is very important. And you can simply derive it just by subtracting one from the other, and this is what you get. Okay? So I will now see what this implies. And essentially what this does in terms of a picturesque way is that the neutrino mass matrix gets connected to the CKM because they're all, and the SO10 connects CKM to E mu tau, comes back to determine the neutrino mixing angle because the PMNS, the mixing angle, is the UL dagger U mu. Okay, so that's really the argument. And it turns out its predictions are really good. Whether this theory is right or not, it certainly gives a lot of nice predictions. So what happened after that is that you have this sum rule, and that sum rule is what I really want to emphasize quite a bit because that has got a very interesting property. You look at this sum rule, you write M nu in terms of the two hierarchical masses that I was telling you about. Now, because of grand unification, the charged lepton and the down quark mass matrices are extremely similar, except for a factor of minus 3 here. So you write them down, and then you see that because the bottom and tau unifies, I think I had a line over here which has disappeared, but because as you go to a grand unification scale, this becomes 1, these to the bottom tau get unified, these two cancel out. So once these two ones cancel out, you have got a mass matrix which is absolutely no hierarchy. Okay, so in other words, the quark mass matrices, the charged lepton mass matrices can be extremely hierarchical, but because of the B tau unification, oh, right here. So you have the gut relation, MB equal to M tau plus of order some lambda square, and you substitute it here, you see that the neutrino mass matrix is completely non-hierarchical. And we haven't assumed any symmetry. It's sort of very natural in the gut theory framework. Okay, so that's our claim. And once you do that, you can now start doing numerology in this theory. And the numerology is, if you have no CP violation, you have 12 parameters and it is very predictive. So we made a calculation of the theta 1, 2, theta 1, 3. We fitted all of these things. The big prediction was that the theta 1, 3 is of order lambda, and the numerical prediction gave something like 0.17 over here. And if you take sine square 2 theta 1, 3 of that, which is around 0.086, the Diabi central value, and this was done in 2003, the Diabi central value is 0.09. Okay, so that's sort of amazing that just happens to work. I'm not claiming that this theory is the right theory, but it certainly has a very unique property that many other theories struggle to have. They put parameters and symmetries and so on. None of that goes into this. Okay, so after this result, of course, people try to analyze this further. They put in CP violation and so on, and there are a lot of really nice works after that. And the prediction for theta 1,3 still remains same. Okay? It's very large and of the order of what is being discovered nowadays. Okay? So that's why it's there for, it may all be an accident or coincidence, but certainly something to think about. Okay? So the large theta 1,3 is there for a typical prediction of SO10 with 126. Okay? So that's the first claim that I would like to make. Okay, so now, beyond this, of course, beyond this, there are many paths you can follow, because after all, you want to understand as completely things as possible, and there is one line of thinking that we have been doing that I certainly, to me, what I told you until now is sort of the most interesting part. This is sort of trying to understand it a little bit more, using more symmetries, etc. And this is what I will spend a few minutes before I go to the discussion of proton decay. Okay? So what you can say is, where does the Yukawa texture that we have assumed come from? Okay? Of course, the usual lore for this kind of discussion is that you take the standard model and you set the fermion masses to zero. What you find is that you have a huge family symmetry group. The quark doublet, up quark, down quark, lepton, electron, n, etc. Okay? And the hope, of course, is that the observed flavor structure is arising because some subgroup of this, or maybe the whole group, we don't know that, some subgroup is what people are focusing right now quite a bit, is a consequence of this symmetry breaks down to a smaller group, and that smaller group has the property that it generates all the Yukawa couplings once you get down to it. Okay? So that's a framework that has been pursued by a lot of people. And the basic idea there is that you take some fields, which you call Flavon fields, because they act along the Flavon direction, and their vacuum expectation values generate for you the Yukawa couplings. Okay? A lot of people have worked on this, and in the context of different models. So we wanted to implement that strategy to see whatever we predicted for theta 1,3, if it is stable once you get this game going. Yeah. Yes. Oh, before this slide. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Actually, the one I showed you, it has got 13 free parameters. And without CP violation, it's 12 free parameters. Then you put in all complex phases. They're all determined by the CKM to be just one phase. If you have too many phases, CKM doesn't work. So it's a set of 13 parameters. So the neutrino sector up to an overall scale, because remember there is an overall scale in the neutrino sector that we cannot determine. But after that, everything is predicted. Okay, for example, the solar to atmospheric mass ratio is predicted. Theta 1,3, theta 2,3, theta 1,2, they're all predicted. Okay. And it's amazing that all of them seem to be of the right order, or at least often even more accurate than that. Okay. Right. Well, I mean, the question of worse depends. You see, okay, the way this fitting is done, we have done a chi-square minimization. So the way the fitting is done is you take the values for the quark masses with their error spreads. And then, you know, the lepton masses with a very little error spread at gut scale. So you put them together, and out comes I think one answer I can give you is that the atmospheric mixing angle seems to be large, okay, compared to 45. It's almost 50 degrees. So maybe that's the one that will kill us, but who knows? Okay. But everything else seems to be okay. Okay, so what is the idea of symmetries game? Well, the point is that for these models to work, what we found is that the one that determines the neutrino mass matrix had almost disformed. There were ones over here, small numbers, and so on. And once you have this kind of a pattern, you would think there is some kind of a fine-tuning going on. Okay. So to avoid that, you need to get this pattern from some symmetry. Then you feel comfortable, because once you have a symmetry, everything is sort of stable under radiative correction. Okay. So what I would like to do for a few minutes is to discuss a symmetry which determines this pattern. And that symmetry is the permutation symmetry in four dimensions. And you have to take certain representations where the triplets, the three families, transform like three-dimensional representation of this group. This group has 24 elements and has got two threes and one, two, and a couple of ones. So that's how you add up to 24. And you take representations of these, and you write down the Yukawa couplings, which are invariant under that. And then you go and play with this and see what you get. Okay. So essentially, here is some details that you don't need to bother about. We took three flavons, and what happens is that once you minimize the superpotential for the flavons, there are three patterns that emerge, and we use all three of them. Okay. And of course, what that does is it determines the Yukawa texture for you. For the one of the tens, it is like this. For the F coupling, the 126 coupling, it predicts a pattern like this, which is what I'm interested in, because this part is what is needed to fit the atmospheric data. And then there is a second 10 that we use, and that doesn't do any damage. It simply has waves along this, which fixes VUB, et cetera. Okay, so these are more details you don't have to bother about. But the message that I want to get across is that the kind of pattern that is needed to understand the neutrinos, you can have from some symmetry. Different people have different ideas of pursuing this.
Sorry,
yeah.
What is this for, the things that are being commuted? Are they the left hand and one family?
No, essentially what... Yeah, no. The S4 essentially the following. If you go up the permutation symmetry group, the lowest permutation symmetry group, which has got a three-dimensional representation, is S4. The S3 has got 2+1, you know, twos and ones. But we have three generations, so we want to sort of have the minimal, simple kind of group that has got a three-dimensional representation, so we can commute them, permute them. Yeah.
But how is the S4 acting?
Oh, the S4 has a three-dimensional representation, which you can write down the 3x3 matrices, and that's how it acts on.
But is there some underlying degrees of freedom?
There could be.
Which are four things, which are being...
There could be some four objects. Now, that I don't know. There could be some four objects which are doing that, but my goal is that we have three generations, and I want to have a group which has got a three-dimensional irreducible representation so that I can permute them and connect the Yukawa coupling. Okay. Now, where that S4 came from, there could be some underlying structure. I don't know. I'm not getting, you know, I have nothing to say about that. But essentially, if we have the symmetry, we have the representation, we can now, you know, connect the different Yukawa couplings, make predictions. That's where my goal is. So, I mean, in some sense, you can think of this as an effective theory, not maybe there is something more fundamental below it which does it. And so we looked at this one. There could be some field theory. I really don't know what kind of. I mean, SU3 gives rise to quarks, but that doesn't, you know. Here, all I'm thinking of is what is the representation that connects three generations. Okay? As soon as I have an irreducible representation, I know that I can, you know, transform one to the other from the matrices of that. Okay, so that's the whole idea. I don't need four objects to do that. Okay. So again, we did that, and we got all kinds of predictions. I think these are the scatter plots for different. I don't think you can see it very well. Even I can't see it very well. But the main point is that we have a theta 1, 3, which is certainly not as large as is being observed, because I now have put in additional symmetry that restricts things and so on. But it is consistent at 3 sigma. And maybe if the 3 sigma gets, even the error bars go down, this model may be ruled out. But the basic, a certain idea may survive. But this is going beyond that, trying to understand the detailed pattern. So maybe we have to use some other group. I don't know. Okay, so that's the plan in this program. Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah, I'm having same trouble also. but this is essentially theta 1, 2. This is the solar angle. This is the theta 1, 3. And you see that the solar angle is near 34, 35, 33 degrees. Hopefully that's clear. And what varies over here is the ratio of solar to atmospheric ratio. So there are parameters, there are error bars and so on. We throw all these things into the program, and then this is the kind of pattern that emerges. And so this is theta 1, 2. So you see that this solar angle is sort of where it should be. This is the 1 sigma, 2 sigma, 3 sigma kind of error contours. And this is theta 2. This is the theta 1, 3. So here you see that it's about 5 degrees or so. Maximum, it can be about 5.4 degrees. And here this is theta 2, 3. So theta 2, 3 is somewhat on the large side. I wish I could have blown up these things a little bit more. But theta 2, 3 is somewhere around 50 degrees. Okay, so these are, again, the error contours, and unfortunately, not so clear. Yeah. But this is all in the web, and hopefully. Okay. Now, there is something interesting that I wanted to point out, which is relevant for Higgs physics, which is that to fit this, to do this fitting, we need a large threshold correction. Because as you know, in the MSSM, as you come down to the weak scale, the MSSM scale, there are large corrections to B quark mass, et cetera, which comes from Gluino and A terms and so on. And this model to fit to work requires large A terms. And once you put in the large A terms, you can sort of have splitting between these stops and so on, et cetera. This is whole supersymmetry talk. But what happens, the bottom line, is that you can predict larger Higgs mass, even as large as 129 GeV. Okay? And also it predicts, okay, then my PDF file got messed up a little bit. So this is stop mass limit of about 755 or 211 GeV, depending on what is the sign of your mu scale. So we looked at all these things as output of this kind of model. Okay? Because for this model to work, this must be the structure of supersymmetric theories. Okay? So that's really. Well, supersymmetry generally predicts light Higgs because you predict the lambda of the standard model, which is the Higgs self-coupling, is now determined by the gauge coupling. So therefore, that's the basic starting point. Now, of course, that predicts that Higgs mass must be less than the Z boson mass, which is, of course, not true. So therefore, you take radiative corrections. And once you take radiative one-loop corrections, two-loop corrections, and so on, what those corrections look like depends on how you break supersymmetry. What's the mass of this top partner, which is mass of the A term, and all those things. So that's the part that I'm talking about.
So how much less than
129? Oh, no, that's the largest value, and here is the plot. It can go down all the way to 116 GeV. Right. No, it's not below. There are points over there, but we cut it off because we have a lower limit of 114 GeV. So it's sort of, we expect somewhere in this range. So largest value is somewhere around 129 GeV, and the lowest 116 or something is where we cut it off.
Because the vacuum becomes unstable.
Right. Yeah. So the
Well,
below 114, you have got the left bound. So we didn't want to go below that. Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know why vacuum should become unstable, but this is. This is what, once you take larger A term, which is really what we need to fit neutrinos, you get that as a prediction. Okay, so that's the bottom line. So let me now go to the next topic, which is the proton decay challenge. And I think we have got 5 minutes, so I will should take care of that. So what is the proton decay challenge? Well, as you know, as soon as you do grand unified theories, there are quarks and leptons in one representation, and there are gauge bosons connecting them. So therefore, proton decay is a natural consequence of that grand unified theory. And what is the current status? Well, super K has limits on various proton decay modes. For example, E plus pi naught, which is the sort of most sensitive limit it has got, is something like 2 × 10⁴ years, and so on, and it goes down. The supersymmetric mode, which is nu bar K plus, again, it's sort of hard to see, I'm sorry, but that is somewhere around 4 × 10⁻³ years, and so on. And it is expected that the proposed hyper-K experiment will push these limits by a factor of 10. So it is important to look at these things. And the only theories which do have definite predictions for proton decay are the grand unified theory. So naturally, therefore, we have to look at that and see if our assumptions are consistent with that, because we have certainly no free parameters at this stage, because grand unification determines the gauge coupling, and the Yukawa couplings are determined by the searches for neutrino masses. Okay, so what are the contributions? We are doing super Susegaard, so we have got two contributions. One is the gauge boson contribution, which is typical of both supersymmetry and non-supersymmetry. And what you find is the E plus pi naught mode is the dominant mode, and that, you know, typical predictions are somewhere around 10⁻³⁵ years. Okay, so it's unlikely that in the next round of searches, you will see this mode. The Higgs-Sino exchange, which is typical of Susegaard theories, there you have got a much more interesting prediction, because it comes from a lower dimensional operator, and therefore you have only radiative correlations to suppress the magnitude, and what you predict is that the proton lifetime is somewhere around 10⁻³ years or so, 10⁻³⁰ to 10⁻³⁰. But this has been a problem for super SU5, for example. The so-called minimal SU5 with supersymmetry is now ruled out because of this prediction, okay? Because now the limits have gone all the way up to 10⁻³ years. So what happens in SO10? Well, we looked at this question. What happens in SO10 is that you have got different diagrams from. Unlike SU5, where you had only one diagram, therefore you had a definite prediction. Now there are two sets of contributions, 10 and 126. And it is possible to cancel so that it is consistent with what we know. I mean, that's not very pretty, but at least it is non-trivial that you can cancel, because even though you know all the Yukawa couplings, there are some mixing parameters. There are not too many of them. There are about 5 parameters in this theory, and you could cancel to fit so many data points, because remember, there are lots of branching ratios which have been upper limited. And we did the same thing for the second model. We did predict something like less than 10⁻³ years for the K plus nu bar mode, and there was no cancellation needed in this case, because the flavor pattern was so predicted, so fixed, that you don't have to use any cancellation. Okay, so just quickly, a couple of side issues that I want to point out. People have looked at this model with a much better numerical analysis to see whether so far we were assuming supersymmetry. But is supersymmetry really essential? And people have pointed out that no, supersymmetry isn't really essential to do all of this. Okay? Because the number of parameters in the fermion sector, of course, doesn't care whether there is supersymmetry or not. Where supersymmetry enters is when you extrapolate the masses to the gut scale. So those values are now different. And so it, however, turns out that it is possible to fit without supersymmetry, again with a large prediction for the sine square theta 1. So at this point, we put out a paper recently where we wanted to look at, if you have no supersymmetry, is it possible that you can say something about the proton decay in a more definite way? Okay. In other words, are there more proton decay modes which can be used to distinguish models? Well, what we found is that the canonical E plus pi naught, nu bar K plus decay modes, which people have talked about so far, have a property that both of them conserve this quantity B minus L. And they all arise from D equal to 6 baryon number violating operators. So that is a whole different talk. But just to summarize its implication for this model is that in SO10, because we are giving the right-handed neutrino a Majorana mass, you have got a B minus L breaking. So therefore, you do expect that there should be departures from these kind of decay modes. Okay, so that's really the key point. And one typical decay mode which differs from these ones is neutron going to E minus pi plus. Okay, because if you look at this mode, here you have got baryon number 1, but lepton number is plus minus 1. So B minus L is conserved. Here you have got B minus L violated by 2 units. Okay. So therefore, what we are proposing is that the hyper-K and the subsequent proton decay searches should look for B minus L violating nucleon decay modes. Of course, it may be a little bit more difficult than that, because typically what you do is you have got a proton, you have E plus, and the E plus annihilates with some of the electrons, and you get a gamma signal. This gives gamma signals, so that's a little easier to detect. And this, of course, has its usual problem that you have, these are sub-Cherenkov kind of velocities. So therefore, you have to probably use liquid argon or something to improve sensitivity. So there may be some issues, like experimental issues like that, which we are not familiar with. But at least we are proposing that this kind of thing you should be able to detect in SO10 without supersymmetry. Okay? And we are predicting the values which are accessible with hyper-K. And you know, here are some details of that, how it comes from. I'm not sure you want to read all of that. But the only thing that I would like you to look at is this operator, which is the source of this new kind of decay modes. Just to remind you, the D equal to 6 modes comes from 3 Qs and an L. Okay? And here, this is completely different. It is 3 Qs and a DC star. There's a singlet and a lepton and a Higgs boson. So there is always a Higgs boson which suppresses the decay mode. So some diagram like this. And the other important point about this idea is that in SU5, these kind of decay modes are completely forbidden, because B minus L is an exact symmetry in that model, whereas SO10 allows that possibility. So in principle, if you found these kind of decay modes, you'll also have a way to distinguish between SO10 and SU5. Okay, so I think I'm coming to the end of my, I'm already out of the time, but just wanted to point out one other thing that's kind of important that we noticed, which is that if you have these kind of decay modes, you don't need leptogenesis to generate baryons, but you can connect the baryon proton decay to baryogenesis, because already lepton number is violated. So for example, we found that there are decays of some super heavy colored triplets with a loop contribution. You can generate enough baryon asymmetry to explain the origin of matter in the universe. You don't need to have delta L equal to 2. So it sort of restores the very early works on gut theories, which were promised as a way of understanding origin of matter. Then that disappeared with the discovery of phalerons. But this might bring it back again, is what we are hoping for. OK, so I think now I'm ready to summarize. So just 2 or 3 points. First is that SO10 models with a particular representation breaking B minus L symmetry is a dream big picture scenario, looks like, for fermion flavor dark matter as well, which means neutrino masses as well as quark masses, mixings, and so on. Observation of large theta 1-3 supports this picture, and correlation of theta 2-3 with end proton decay search can provide additional evidence for the model. I think there is one interesting catch here which one should point out, that if the dark matter is light enough, or if some particles like right-handed W's or G prime are discovered LHC, most this picture will definitely be ruled out. Okay, so we would expect the dark matter to be, you know, sort of in the heavier range and so on. Okay, I think I stop here.
So is the point here that you expect the light beam, you expect sort of a sharp relation between the neutrino masses?
Yeah, essentially what I'm saying here is that there have been some discussion, I think, almost for the last 7-8 years, that in the context of supersymmetry, it has to be a Beano, because otherwise such a light guy will be in conflict with Z decay width. So, and once it is a Beano, then its annihilation cross section becomes so large that it will overclose the universe. So that's there are, I think, a lot of people have worked on it. And this number I got from a paper written by Hooper and Plan, but there are probably. The PDG quotes a different number. He says in CMSSM, It's 47 GeV, and I have not understood that, so I didn't quote it over here. But this is supposed to be for general supersymmetric models. It is essentially the B-nose over closing in terms of relic density.
The LHC 2014 continues to rule out supersymmetry up to say 10 TeV. Does this affect us at all?
10 TeV, I think, will affect it. But then we see what we are doing is the, as I just mentioned quickly in one slide, the whole neutrino mass quark flavor picture does not really rely so strongly on supersymmetry, because we could have an equally good fit without supersymmetry. It's just that the values of the quark masses mixings extrapolated to gut scale value changes. So you just have a different fit, but it works for both models. The coupling constant coming works for SO10. Coupling constant coming together does not work for SU5, but SO10 it works, because there are intermediate symmetries, there are more particles that could be at intermediate scale, and so on. So the unification is no problem with or without supersymmetry in case of SO10. I mean, that was known way before. I mean, we wrote several papers showing that in case of non-supersymmetric SO10, all you need is intermediate scale close to the gut scale, because there is extra symmetries and running of the couplings are different, and so on.
The fact that there's free generation is just an input in this.
Yes.
Also, you said something about reviving the old variogenesis.
Oh, yes.
I didn't understand.
Oh, okay. So the history goes like this. In the very early, the late 70s, people thought that the grand unified theories lead to proton decay, and if you have CP violation in proton decay interactions, then you have an asymmetry between protons and antiprotons, baryons and antibaryons. But then, of course, in the simple grand unified theories, B minus L was supposed to be good symmetry. So therefore, if that is a good symmetry, you can show that the weak scales phalerons will completely wash it out. What we are pointing out now is that if you go to theories like SO10 and not SU5, if you go to theories like SO10, then there are new interactions which violate B minus L pretty much at the gut scale. So there are new proton decay modes. So therefore, CP violation in combination with those can generate baryon asymmetry. And those guys will not be washed out by the electroweak phase transition. Okay, because electroweak phase transition has the property that it conserves B minus L. So if you have a B minus L already violated, that doesn't change that asymmetry. So you could have a connection directly not to neutrino mass, but to proton decay. So that would sort of be a different connection between high scale physics and the origin of matter.
Any further questions? If not, then let's thank you.